Last time we were together, we saw how God gifted Solomon in the very beginning of his solo reign over Israel with the gift of special wisdom. And Solomon praised the Lord for that, and immediately he became known for exercising this sort of wisdom that was not particularly common for younger people. Because remember, Solomon is perhaps at the tail end of his teen years, maybe at the very beginning of his 20s. 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 16, is the famous incident of wisdom displayed by Solomon. It says, "Then two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him." Now, prostitution was not supposed to be happening in Israeli society. And so these women might be practicing something on the sly, some sort of underground activity, but the impact of it was that both of them ended up pregnant. Now, I will mention, though, that the wording here makes it possible that these are not women engaging in prostitution for finances, but rather just women with loose moral activities, because the same sort of phrase is used in Hebrew and Greek for that sort of mindset. And so it could be that we just have a couple of single moms who got pregnant sexual activity that Israelis were not supposed to be engaging in outside of marriage. But their situation has been looked at by lower courts already, and those lower courts have not been able to sort out the best way to deal with the claims in this case. So it has come up to Solomon now. So the one woman said, "Oh, my Lord, this woman and I live in the same house. And I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. And then on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth." So you get the understanding that these two single moms have been living together, maybe pooling resources, and both of them have their babies within 3 days of one another. And then comes the problem. "We were alone. There was no one else with us in the house. Only we two were in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. She arose at midnight, took my son from beside me while your servant slept, and laid him at her breast, and laid her dead son at my breast. And when I rose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, behold, he was not the child that I'd born." So the claim by the one woman is that this woman's baby was killed by accidentally rolling over and smothering the baby in the middle of the night. And so she swapped her dead son for my living son. And at first I thought my son had just simply died in the night. But then I got to looking at him really close in the morning light, and it wasn't my son. A mother knows their child, and this is not my baby. Now, the other woman, verse 22, said, "No, the living child is mine. The dead child is yours." And the first said, "No, the dead child is yours. The living child is mine." And thus they spoke before the king. Now, today, we wouldn't have a problem with this because we just simply take a DNA test and match the genetic code of mom with baby. But they didn't have that back at this time. And as we've already seen in the story, there were no witnesses to this. And it's basically a case of she said and she said. And that's why it's come up through the ranks of the judicial system, is because no judge can figure out how do you decide which mom is the genuine article. Because this is a big deal. To take a baby away from its real mom and give it to the mother who actually was at fault for killing her own baby, that's not good. So every judge has kind of said, no, I don't want to make the decision here. I need to bump it up to somebody else. So now the king's got it. So the king summarizes it. Then the king said, the one says, this is my son that's alive. Your son is dead. The other says, no, but your son is dead and my son is the living one. And then the king said, bring me a sword. So he thinks about it for a moment. Maybe he prays about it. And he says, one of you soldiers, come over here with your sword. So the sword was brought before the king. And then the king said, divide the living child in two and give half to the one and half to the other. Now you have to understand that what happens next happens really, really fast, instantly. And there's a lot of crosstalk here that can't be shown in the text that we're looking at, but we have to imagine it. That the moment Solomon says, chop the baby in half and give them each a piece, both moms start talking at the same time. Verse 26, then the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because her heart yearned for her son, oh, my Lord, give her the living child, by no means put him to death. But understand, at the exact same time, the other mom, who is hurting on the inside because of the loss of her own baby, and she just feels that everybody ought to suffer. She said, well, he shall neither be mine nor yours. Divide him. So she is only thinking about the other mom not getting the joy of motherhood since she herself has lost that ability. And Solomon watched these reactions that took place instantaneously. And from their reactions, he knew immediately who the real mom was. So the king answered and said, give the living child to the first woman, by no means put him to death. Because he had no intention of killing the baby. He just wanted to see how they'd react to him saying, cut the baby up. Don't put him to death. She's his mother. And all Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king because they perceived that the wisdom of the king was with him, or the wisdom of God was with him to do justice. See, none of these guys in the lower courts, none of them thought about provoking this sort of emotional reaction from the women to see which one was willing to sacrifice their baby in order to keep it alive, and which one was willing to let the baby be killed just so she could feel that everybody is going to have to be sad in this situation, because that's where I'm at. So this story goes out and everybody starts realizing Solomon's pretty sharp for his age, because he's got to be right around 19 or 20 at this time. And they understand now what Solomon is understanding, and that is God has given him a special gift of insight to figure things out. And this gives confidence to the Israeli people that Solomon is going to do a really good job as their king. Now, I believe this might be the best place for us to bring in a couple of Solomon's psalms. So turn to Psalm number 72. Psalm number 72, which I think goes well at this point because it's a request to God for the ability to do justice. And that's exactly what Solomon had prayed for and which he's now demonstrating. So Psalm number 72. The superscription says, of Solomon. Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to the royal son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your people with justice. So that's what he wants. That's what's burning in his soul at this early stage of his kingdom. Let the mountains bear prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. So he wants the nation to do well. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. So he wants to do justice. May they fear you while the sun endures, and as long as the moon throughout all generations. May he be like rain that falls on the mown grass, like showers that water the earth. In his days may the righteous flourish and peace abound till the moon be no more. So he poetically prays that God will help him be good to the people, just like God provides good agricultural weather to the prosperous people of Israel, where the rains come at just the right time to bring the grains to their peak. And how the sun and the moon are there where they need to be at just the right time. He wants to be the same way, providing God's assistance to the people of Israel. Verse 8, may he have dominion from sea to sea. That would be from the Sea of the Mediterranean on the west, all the way over to the Dead Sea, obviously, on the east, but I think it's also possible there's something here about the Gulf of Aqaba, the Red Sea, being on that southeastern border too, because Solomon will have a port in the Gulf of Aqaba, out of which he's going to run some of his trade ships. And may his dominion be from the river, that's the Euphrates River, clear up in the north. Remember, David had tributary kingdoms all the way to the Euphrates. And those were handed over intact to Solomon. So from the river to the ends of the earth. And so all the way to the Arabian Desert, all the way down to the Sinai Desert, and the Gulf of Aqaba. So lots and lots of territory. May desert tribes bow down before him and his enemies lick the dust. That's a poetic way of talking about how they fall down on their faces in front of him. May the kings of Tarshish and of the coastlands render him tribute. Now, Tarshish, we usually think of it as being the Tarshish that's associated with Spain. So that would be the Mediterranean side. And it seems to be like the Phoenicians set up trading outposts all over the Mediterranean, Tarshish in Spain being the farthest one west. But there is also apparently another Tarshish that's associated historically with someplace over in the Indian subcontinent. And we've got at least some hints that Solomon may have sent trade missions that direction as well. And so it's a little hard, I think, to sort out which Tarshish might be talked about here. May the kings of Sheba and Seba bring gifts. That's places down in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. May all kings fall down before him, all nations serve him. And that's most certainly the case that will happen before Solomon's kingdom is finished, is that he has got far-flung relationships with other kingdoms. Verse 12, for he delivers the needy when he calls, the poor, and him who has no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight. This is the mindset of Solomon at the very beginning. He is devoted and dedicated to doing things right and protecting those that can't protect themselves. Verse 15, long may he live. may gold of Sheba be given to him. And that will definitely come to pass. He's going to have huge amounts of gold being brought in as tribute each year. May prayer be made for him continually, and blessings invoked for him all the day. So here's Solomon writing a song in which he prays to God that people are praying for him. May there be abundance of grain in the land, on the tops of the mountains, may it wave. May its fruit be like Lebanon, and may people blossom in the cities like the grass of the field. So prosperity for the entire nation. May his name endure forever. May his fame continue as long as the sun. And certainly that is true. We still talk to this day, 3,000 years later, about the wisdom of Solomon and the glory of his kingdom. May people be blessed in him. All nations call him blessed. Blessed be he who is the God of Israel, who alone does wondrous things. Blessed be his glorious name forever. May the whole earth be filled with his glory. So Solomon wraps this up by pointing out that all blessings should be directed ultimately toward the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, God the Father, the one who created all things and who brings blessing into the Israeli people. And then it closes up with Amen and Amen, which is the Hebrew way of saying, that's true, that's true. And it was a responsive way of saying that you agreed with whatever statement has just been made or the one that's about to follow. And then, since we're here, notice that there's a little notation at the end of this psalm in the book of Psalms that says, the prayers of David, the son of Jesse, are ended. And so whoever it was that made the final collection order of the book of the Psalms divided it up into three sections, and the first two seem to be Davidic psalms. And Solomon's psalm is kind of thrown in there at the tail end of the Davidic section. And then that leaves one other psalm that's attributed to Solomon, and I think now is as good a time as any to put it in. So Psalm 127 has a superscription of a song of ascents, and we talked about how that might mean this was to be sung by people, the Levites standing along the stairs heading up to the house of prayer that's going to be built by King Solomon, or it might be that it was to be sung by pilgrims as they walked up to the Temple Mount. Either way, it's a great song, and it says of Solomon. Then it says this, unless he who is builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Well, Solomon's getting ready to build the house of God. He's getting ready to build his own palace house. And a little reminder here, if God's not involved in the building project, you're just wasting your time. And not just that, unless he who is watches over the city, the watchmen stay awake in vain. It's in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. So Solomon writes down that, you know, everything that we do, if we don't do it for God, we're wasting our time. Because God is what makes things worthwhile. And then the next part is all about kids. Behold, children are a heritage from he who is. The fruit of the womb, a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. So kids are precious. Kids are gifts from God. And they're the ones that actually kind of help us be strong inside of this world and in this culture, because we know that we're sending these kids out to do God's will and God's work. That's the job of a godly parent, is to send their kids out like little arrows to do God's work. So two great psalms, I think, both attributed to Solomon. Now in 1 Kings chapter 4, when we return to that narrative, it kicks off with a list of officials. King Solomon was king over all Israel. These are his high officials. Azariah, the son of Zadok, was the priest. Now, that apparently dates this a little bit later in Solomon's reign, because Zadok was the priest at the beginning of Solomon's reign. Elihoreph and Ahijah, the sons of Shisha, were secretaries. Lots of paperwork in a kingdom. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was recorder. You've got to keep histories. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the army. We know that that happened after the execution by Benaiah of Joab. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. Now, that was true at the very beginning of Solomon's reign. But remember that Abiathar, because of his support of Joab and his support King Adonijah, Prince Adonijah, Abiathar was sent into exile very early on. And then Adoniram, the son of Abda, was in charge of the forced labor. So they need lots of labor in order to get the building projects done. And so this guy is kind of the head of making sure all that falls into place well. Now, the next verses in this chapter, it describes Solomon's organization of the kingdom. And I believe that a lot of this is things that come up later in the kingdom. I've reduced it into a chart form. It's basically all the different places in Israel that have to supply things to the kingdom and who's in charge of that particular area of the kingdom. Let's go down to, where are we at here? 1 Kings chapter 5 is where I think we want to go next, because the last part of chapter number 4 is clearly from later in David's kingdom, and so we're going to save that for later. So 1 Kings chapter number 5, we're going to get serious now about the building of the temple. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon when he heard that they had anointed him king in place of his father, for Hiram always loved David. So now this is a reference to when Solomon became the solo ruler. Remember, he ruled with his father for several years, and Hiram would have been aware of that. But now that David is dead, Hiram sends condolences, but also encouragement. And now that his father has passed away, Solomon knows that he is free to begin the actual work on the temple. Verse 2, Solomon sent word to Hiram, "You know that when David my father could not build a house for the name of he who is his God because of the warfare with which his enemies surrounded him, until he who is put them under the soles of his feet. But now he who is my God has given me rest on every side. There's neither adversary nor misfortune. And so I intend to build a house for the name of he who is my God, as he who is said to David my father, your son whom I will set on your throne in your place shall build the house for my name. Now therefore, command that cedars of Lebanon be cut for me." Now David had already kind of made some prearrangements here, but they didn't want to actually cut these timbers until they were going to be used. So now Solomon says, "We're ready for the construction project. I need you to start sending me the great big timbers. So command that the cedars of Lebanon be cut for me, and my servants will join your servants, and I will pay you for your servants such wages as you set, for you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timbers like the Sidonians. Tyre and Sidon is the area of Phoenicia, and the Phoenicians were world-renowned for building very large and efficient ships and great big buildings using big things of lumber. I mean, great big pillars made from whole trees, and the cedars of Lebanon were world famous for that. Even today, if you look at the Lebanese flag, you'll see a cedar of Lebanon being highlighted on it because of that history. Verse 8, Hiram sent to Solomon saying, I've heard the message that you've sent to me, and I'm ready to do all you desire in the matter of cedar and cypress timber, both of these very fragrant. My servants shall cut it down, shall bring it down to the sea from Lebanon, and I'll make it into rafts to go by sea to the place you direct, and I will have them broken up there, and you shall receive it. Now, we do not understand how they can do all these things because we don't have the remnants of their technology. But they were able to cut these massive trees on the mountainsides of Lebanon up in the north and bring them down to the Mediterranean, where they'd bind them into floating rafts, sail them down the coast, then break them up and bring them inland to Jerusalem, a couple of days normal walking distance, and that's where they're going to start starting to be used in the construction. So this is an amazing project done by highly professional, skilled persons. And Solomon is making all of the financial arrangements and the payment arrangements for this skilled labor. But we'll interrupt ourselves there and come back about this tomorrow.